As black abolitionists fought for emancipation, some black Americans were slaveholders. This contradiction is just one in the complicated history of the black elite, and this group has attracted much commentary. W.E.B. Du Bois called them the Talented Tenth. They would be responsible for ensuring civil rights for all African Americans. But later in the 20th century, this group was chastised for being merely bourgeois. Critic Margot Jefferson has added her perspective on privileged African Americans, and she provides this criticism through the lens of her own upbringing in upper-class black Chicago. Here she is reading an excerpt from her poignant, incisive memoir, Negroland, about the black elite.
Most whites knew little about us. Only a few cared to know. We were taught that we embodied the best that was known and thought of Negro life. We were taught to resent the relative lack of attention our achievements garnered. We were taught that we were better than the whites who looked down on us, that we were better than most whites, period. But that this would rarely, if ever, be acknowledged by white people with all their entitlement. Not the entitlement a government provides, but the kind history bestows. This is your birthright, says history. Privilege is provisional. Privilege can be denied, withheld, offered grudgingly and summarily withdrawn. Entitlement is impervious to the kinds of verbs that modify privilege. Our people have had to work, scrape for privilege, gobble it down when those who would snatch it away weren't looking. Keep a close watch.
Margaret Jefferson joined me in advance of her appearance at the Atlanta History Center tomorrow. We spoke about her memoir, starting with the title. Negroland is not a physical locale, but a name you give to the social order you and your family inhabited.
Yes, exactly.
Why the name Negroland?
Well, it's a time and a place, and the time has so much to do with the choice of names that we as a people have claimed, have fought for in different historical periods. I am writing about the first half, basically, of the 20th century, and Negro had replaced colored. Negro capitalized as the word that aspiring, accomplished, racially conscious blacks, as we now say, or African Americans, Negro was the word they chose and wanted. And that is very much the word, with all the emphasis that a capital letter can give, dignity, accomplishment, hard work, achievement. I was brought up very, very much, in the presence of that word. I picked land. I coined the phrase Negro land because land has so many rich and haunting meanings. There is homeland, a place you share spiritually and often physically with people, a culture, a world, not necessarily a geographic space, but it can be. If you think of the segregated neighborhoods that were typical of Chicago and of many other Negro neighborhoods, you could refer to all black and all white neighborhoods as opposing, adjoining, contending and contentious lands. So I wanted all those meanings, and I wanted that sense of a space that was unto itself and yet bordered by a larger world.
The essence of this self-examination at the heart of the book is in a question you raise early in Negroland, and that is, how do you parse class, race, family, and temperament?
Yeah, there is so much literature, some of it very, very fine, But some of it very simplistic about, you know, the black condition, about, you know, African-American history and how, you know, sociology and politics have marked us. And often this material confounds or excludes the way that social class and race and particular historical periods and very much gender, how they are all intermingling and intermeshing. And I wanted to use my life as a kind of, use myself as a kind of specimen, you know, through which to examine, you know, these constant shiftings. People will often say, not necessarily to me, but, you know, to say other women, have you, black women, have you suffered more as a black or as a woman? And I used to ask this question as a young feminist to older, progressive black women. And, you know, I realized after a time that it wasn't a good question. They were always saying, well, it depends on the situation, the circumstance, we mustn't forget class, that, you know. And so I thought, all right, let me do this and let me not turn away from the particularities of temperament and of your family, your intimate relations with your mother and father, because those two can sometimes get obscured, you know, in the kind of official discourses, nonfiction discourses about race and class and gender in this country.
The book provides detailed historical background on the forebears of the black elite. In 1957, when the Chicago sociologist E. Franklin Frazier published Black Bourgeoisie, what impact did that make?
Well, that created in the Negro world something of a scandal. E. Franklin Frazier was a Marxist and a stern, fierce, no illusions of any sort, man. And he essentially said, documenting it with figures, statistics, etc., wait a minute. This world that so grandly calls itself an elite, an upper class, the Black 400, they're a petty bourgeoisie. They're, you know, petty bourgeois. That's what they are. And they are deceiving themselves, and they have turned away from the kind of political fighting that, in fact, their people need. So this was felt like an excoriation, and it both shamed and angered many, many members of this world. I remember first reading it, or reading at it, as a teenager, and being, you know, kind of shocked and, I wouldn't say appalled, but very rattled. And then reading it later in the mid to late 60s and being very impressed at his intelligent courage.
What was the double consciousness?
That was Du Bois's term, From the Souls of Black Folk, which was published in the first year, 1903, first years of the 20th century. And he said there were, you know, there were these two modes of warring, of seeing oneself, always warring within a black person. One was, you know, the struggle we all have to see ourselves as individuals, and the other was this constant pressure, really imposed, enforced, to see ourselves through the angry, contemptuous, bigoted eyes of a white world.
Tell us about your parents.
Well, my parents actually met in New Orleans. My father was an intern, possibly a resident. My mother was a young social worker. His family had immigrated from Mississippi to Los Angeles, and he had decided to leave Los Angeles because he wanted finally to practice at Provident Hospital, which was a very outstanding all-Black hospital in Chicago. My mother's family had immigrated from another part of Mississippi to St. Louis. She was born there, and her mother became a widow. Young widows in the early 20th century had to be very practical and mindful, and decided that there would be more opportunities for her, her second husband, and her young daughter in Chicago. So they left the shelter of that St. Louis world where she had relatives and in-laws and moved to Chicago. She subsequently divorced because she felt the second husband was not sufficiently ambitious. She took a series of jobs, which included being a dressmaker, being a political operative on a very local level in the Democratic Party, and being one of the city's first Black police women. She ended up owning a couple of buildings in real estate. And her adored daughter, my mother, ended up graduating from the University of Chicago and studying social work there, though she did not finish her graduate studies. And she and my father were part of this world, this society of eager, young, Negro, as they called themselves proudly, couples, building careers, mostly the men particularly, but also women as doctors, lawyers, businessmen, accountants, teachers, from elementary school to college, and, you know, making lives, settling in Chicago and making lives for themselves and their children. And, you know, planning always, you know, on this security and progress.
You and your sister had a prestigious private school education. You attended the University of Chicago Lab School, where you were to, as you put it, eschew petty snobberies. Intellectual superiority was our task. But, Margot, I was shocked to read about the prejudice you and your family encountered, even in this school renowned for its progressive approach to education, and the neighborhood. Hyde Park is a mainstay of liberalism, and I think the people who lived there for decades thought of it as just a bastion of liberal thought.
Well, in certain real ways, Hyde Park was. And I think we have to keep that in mind and make it the measure of how constrained social progress and progressive thought were. Hyde Park was the only integrated neighborhood, pleasantly, politely, benignly integrated neighborhood in Chicago. That is absolutely true. This was accomplished by severe social engineering on the part of the university. They were very, very careful to make sure that poor Blacks and poorer Blacks and poorer whites were pushed out of the Hyde Park they wanted to preserve for professors and students. And they had what we would basically now call quota systems for just how many and what kinds of very, very socially, professionally qualified Negro families would be allowed in, even down to which blocks. Within that stringently arranged frame, many, many more things, just socializing, political organizing, etc., many more things were possible than in most other sections of the city. But, you know, those confines were there, too. Similarly, at Lab, my sister and I made real friends, and we had wonderful teachers. Simultaneously, there were these sudden intrusions of prejudice, never violent and never systematic, but hurtful and periodic. And that simply was life in the United States for any Black person, any Negro in those days. And, you know, those were the levels of consciousness that most white people were working with. And, you know, it was as sheltered an environment as one could possibly find, I believe, at Lab and at Francis Parker.
The portion of the book where you write about skin color and grades of hair and beauty standards was a real window into the complexities that Black women dealt with in terms of appearance and self-image.
Oh, indeed. The word now used, and I, you know, it still operates for certainly the skin color distinctions, with lighter being much preferred and darker often being sneered at, blatantly or subtly. Colorism is the term we now use. We did not have that word in my days. And those standards were absolutely accepted, endorsed, embraced by us up until really the mid to late 60s, when the Black Power movement actually began to challenge that with the aesthetic and the ideology of Black is beautiful. That's when you first saw naturals, you know, that's when, the kinds of features and faces that you can now see on people like, say, the models Alec Weck or model Alec Weck or the actress Lupita Nyong'o, that's when, you know, those began to become exciting aesthetic and female possibilities. We were double whammied by the generally obsessive beauty standards imposed on girls and women. Fashion magazines, the models, the clothes, the girdles, the elaborate codes of manners, and the white standards that found so many ways to designate every aspect of Black female appearance in particular, inadequate to inferior.
In a book already packed with the injustice and indignity of racism, then you have this section on suicide, and that was the most disturbing of all. Did your parents know the extent of your despair?
No, they did not, though my mother, I think that a very good friend of mine told me years later that she had talked a little bit to my mother. She had confided some of her worries to my mother, which I found very interesting. They did know that I was seeing a therapist, and they had helped me financially at several points when I needed that, in fact, before I could fully pay my own therapy bills. But no, I didn't really want them to know the full extent. In some ways, it was my private world, and I wanted to keep it that way. I suppose I wanted to protect them, but I also wanted to protect my own grief and unhappiness.
It was chilling to read your death aphorisms, as you call them. And I wondered if you could have written what you revealed in this book if you knew your parents were going to read it.
Well, that's an interesting question. I could not have written this book, certainly not 20 years ago. They both would have been alive. And also, I was still more in the grip of this material. Now, could I have written it with, you know, basically the self-knowledge? Let's say I am who I am now, but my parents were still alive. Could I have written it? Yes, it would have scared me, because much of the time I was writing this book, my mother was still alive, and I knew that she was going to read some of it, if not all of it. And that did scare me, and sometimes that slowed me down, but I kept going.
You write so lovingly of her, and both your parents make a very vivid impression, as does your sister. But I think the part you write about your mother that is most memorable is that she wrote in a letter to a friend that she was so happy. Sometimes I almost forget I'm a Negro. It's so sad.
And that's something. She ended the letter to a dear friend. I found that letter, I think it was in the 70s. And I can remember being in the kitchen or the living room with my mother, my sister, and my niece. And I read this aloud, and my sister and niece, I could see their face mirroring mine. They were so stricken and so moved, because my mother was very charming, and she could be very serious when you spoke to her about, you know, life and serious matters, matters of substance. But she was also very controlled, and none of us had quite expected that. She was very controlled in telling us her personal griefs, if you will, about racism. My father, in some ways, was more forthright. So this was just stunning to us. And the letter was so full of vibrancy and intelligence. And, you know, here it was. Here she was, fully acknowledging the complexities, the struggles of race, and saying also at the same time, we all are. We are independent human beings, and we claim all the pleasures and happiness that life can give.
Toward the end of the book, you include a chapter on the comic aspects or the irony of dealing with race, class, and gender issues. Would you share some examples of your relativity tales?
Yes. One of my favorites involves two friends and I being at, I think it was a book party, some kind of literary cocktail party. And I am, you know, clearly recognizably an African-American with light brown skin. One of my friends is usually mistaken for Mediterranean, possibly Sephardic Jewish. The third friend is usually mistaken for a white Protestant. And we're all chatting together, and for some reason, we start talking about telling race stories. I'm not sure why. Maybe that was our way of sort of saying, well, we're the only black people here in this room. As we're talking, one friend in particular is talking about black, so-called black accents, and the lightest friend is saying, well, you know, I don't, you know, the closest thing to a black accent that I've ever heard is the voice of the white Mississippian that I'm dating. And at that point, a young white man joins us. He just comes over and stands there to join our conversation. And we're a little piqued, you know, because it's a private conversation, but we can't really be rude. So my friend, to put him in his place, says, you know, I was just saying that I'm dating a white guy from Mississippi, and whenever I'm around him, I start talking like what people think of as a black person. And without batting an eyelash, this young man said, yes. He said, I'm dating a white man from Mississippi, and the same thing happened to me. And I looked at him and I said, well, congratulations. You've just made yourself the most exotic person in our group.
That's great. Margo Jefferson, thank you very much for talking with me. And it really is marvelous to read Negro Land.
Oh, thank you. And I liked our talk very much.